California is home to wildfires. 1 in 12 homes in the state exist in areas facing severe wildfire threat. The Sacramento Bee's Destined to Burn series is a collaborative project with other media showcasing this new way of life in California. Lauren Gustis and Ryan Sabalo join me next on Studio Sacramento.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
Driving now into the neighborhood where I lived for 3 years. We bought a house. You can see that much of the neighborhood has been burned down. Holy smokes.
Lauren, this project is unusual in it was a collaboration between papers. What compelled the Bee to take this approach to doing this story?
That's a great question. When we came away from the breaking news that was coverage of the campfire, you know, we weren't done with the story. And I think any journalist that has covered a major event of significance, no less a fire that that killed 85 people, would tell you that, you know, a story stays with you. And we wanted to make an impact, if we could, with future work that we would do. And we thought that the best opportunity to do that would be to speak with one voice. And so we started to talk with other local news organizations, including the Chico Enterprise Record and Gannett papers, including the Reading Record Searchlight, and then the Associated Press jumped in, and all of a sudden we had a fairly large group of collaborators who met on a regular basis to determine how we could make policy impact with a reporting project of significance. We decided to make it available to anyone who wanted to use it. So again, that's pretty groundbreaking. Usually we tend to hug our stories or hold on to our work, but we gave this work to anyone who wanted to publish it across any platform in California. That was groundbreaking. We, to our knowledge, we have not seen journalism like that in the past. I don't think we would have, because we may have been too proud. However, the topic was too important and times have changed. And so we published the project collaboratively across a number of different platforms. And the day after it published, California Governor Gavin Newsom, in a press conference related to wildfire coverage, pointed out how significant it was, recommended that everybody take a look, and that we consider the policy implications that the reporting had borne out.
And it does seem unusual in that typically papers are in rivalry with mm-hmm. each other. Yeah. Does it say something about how it is that journalism is evolving and changing, that with college you can attack a story this big and pool resources together?
Mm-hmm. We used to think that Chico or Reading or Stockton or Los Angeles or San Francisco was the competition, right, with respect to that printed newspaper product. Today, anytime someone picks up a cell phone, we have competition. They could be playing Words with Friends, they could be on YouTube or Instagram, you name it, right? We're fighting for their attention 24 hours a day. And so the playing field has changed, and if we can speak with one voice on an issue of significance, and again, fan those resources out, as you said, Scott, so we have a data reporter over here, we have a drone photographer over here, we have an experienced, wildland firefighter, reporter in Ryan over here, we can pull those resources together and build something that's even stronger than what we could do on our own or individually.
Ryan, what was it? We watched the video, and we know that for you, this was more than just professional, it was personal. What did you take away from this experience?
The experience of reporting on this project? Yeah, I think the big takeaway from all of this, I mean, aside from the personal issues that I had of covering places where I grew up, and I have deep personal ties to these places, right, is that this, we could have a campfire all over California. And, I mean, from some of the ritziest places in Southern California to poor, impoverished towns up near Mount Shasta, near the Oregon border. We have built into very fire-prone areas, and we have millions of acres of land across the West that really has not had any sort of fire on it for years, or for better part of a century. Those two factors, combined with climate change, combined with invasive plants, all kinds of different things, have created where we could have basically a campfire anywhere in California.
One of the things that you reference in your reporting is just sort of the randomness of where fire strikes and how it strikes. When you were driving through areas that you have been familiar with for years, was there anything that jumped out at you in terms of, like, you know, you're surprised that this burned as opposed to someplace that didn't?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think our reporting, when you go into these disaster areas, and in California, journalists like myself work for newspapers, TV stations, we have access to fire areas that the general public does not. It's right in state law. So we get to kind of be in there as the stuff is unfolding. And it appears so random at times what you see. You'll see neighborhoods completely burned down, and in the middle of it, there might be a house that's standing. And it's, you know, or there might be a cluster of houses that are still standing. But what our reporting bore out in the campfire was there's probably a good reason why a number of those houses that survived the campfire survived.
Why is that?
What we found was over half of the houses that survived the campfire, 51%, let me back up for a second. Of the houses that survived the campfire, the ones that were built after 2008 had a much higher rate of success. 51% of those ones survived.
And Ryan, what was the rate of success overall in Paradise?
I think it was like 18%.
Mm-hmm. 18%?
Or no, it was 10% of the houses survived. Houses built before 2008 had it was like 18% mm-hmm. of those survived. So is this mix, but very few houses survived. The ones that were built to these new building standards after 2008 had a much higher rate.
And what are the building standards?
The building standards are, so in 2008 they decided that they need to what they call fire harden the house to make them less likely to catch fire from these embers that blow in during these fires. And it's better roofing, double pane windows so that they don't blow in during the heat, grates over vents in the attic to make sure that embers don't blow in, and then things like siding that's less flammable, like stucco.
And Lauren, when all of these things go into how it is that fire and how we build for fire mm-hmm. seems to be something that has shifted, and that with the older homes, there hasn't been much of a focus on that. The megaphone that you talk about coming together as a consortium and Governor Newsom's reaction, is this the only way to get a platform to address issues of this magnitude?
I hope not. I hope that there are many mechanisms or many levers that we could pull. In the Destined to Burn reporting that we did, we found that, and Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, 6% of California's housing stock is built after 2008.
Yeah.
Right. So there are very few homes that are fire safe or fire hardened, if you will. There's no home that's fire safe, I suppose. It's fire hardened. However, if we can create awareness for the fact that we have an opportunity to talk about, from a policy standpoint, how we might support retrofits that would make more homes fire hardened, that's a constructive step. So is a very local conversation about defensible space and how, if you and I are neighbors, we communicate and we collaborate with respect to keeping our neighborhoods clean.
Speaking of defensible space, one of the videos that you have on your Facebook page talks about what happens with defensible space and what a difference it makes. Describe that for us.
Yeah, so one of the things that the research has found is people have this assumption that when a fire burns through, it's the flames that catch your house on fire. And actually, it's usually not in these big fires that burn through these neighborhoods. It's actually the houses catching each other on fire. And what they found is, and they've actually set up houses up in the boreal forest and set the forest on fire, and they built these houses. And what they found was that if you have a gap between the trees, the flames are not going to actually, between the flames and your house, the heat doesn't get such where it actually causes your stuff to combust. What you do get, though, is in a big wind, you get the embers to blow in. And so what they really advocate for, and if you see these videos, it's incredible. People, they created a house in one of these labs that had leaf litter around the edges, and they had pine needles in the gutters, and they blew a bunch of embers on it. And you see the house just go on these little spots, just start to catch and blow up.
Right.
And it is remarkable to see it. And so that's why, you know, driving through the campfire last year, I see this house, and all around it, every house is gone. I mean, down to the foundation. And there's one house standing in the middle of it that hasn't even been completed building yet. It's got wood siding, right? And it survived. And I go, why did that one survive? And if you look, I looked at the picture I took at it after I saw this presentation showing this, how the embers work. There was no leaf litter around. They had cleared it all the way down to bare dirt. They had trimmed the trees around it so it's a wide open, there's no canopy, and that home just, there was nothing for it to catch. So,
on issues like that, doesn't that run counter to much of the move these days to do things like smart growth, houses closer together, compressing the space between buildings, things like that? That you're saying that it, but for fire suppression purposes, that those distances and that and keeping those spaces clean are critical in order to be able to preserve housing.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about urban infill, I mean, in the middle of a city, it makes more sense from a planning and getting more people to live in urban areas. But in these, what they call the wildland urban interface, I mean, that's one of the things we saw in the campfire in our analysis. Mobile homes, even new mobile homes built after 2008, there was no difference in survival rates. And it's because those houses are, or because mobile homes are typically stacked very close together.
Ryan, you've thought a lot about this. You know, love to talk about how people will live in the woods, right, regardless of the risk, and how you are passionate about being outdoors and enjoying what, sure, California has to offer from that standpoint. So just kind of,
yeah,
walk us through.
I mean, I lived in Redding for 6 years. I was a reporter for the Record Searchlight, and we decided to buy a house in a neighborhood that, as you saw in the video, that eventually burned down. And when I bought the house, I told my wife, because I'd covered fires right out there, that the neighborhood was probably going to catch fire someday. And it's part of the California experience, I think, to build or to want to live in these places with these beautiful landscapes. We were right next to the river. We had these beautiful running trails. I mean, it's gorgeous to live in this place. But you've got to also have the understanding, which I don't think a lot of people do. Maybe the campfire, maybe the car fire has reawakened some of this understanding that, you know, if you choose to live in these places, there is a substantial risk there.
And how big is the risk statewide?
Well, right now, 2.7 million people live in these areas that CAL FIRE has declared a high hazard area. And that number's probably going to increase because the old maps that they used to do this didn't account for wind factors. It was mostly vegetation and landscape terrain. So 2.7 million people is a lot of people. You have entire communities where 90% of the entire town or city is inside one of these areas. Malibu's one. You have the whole Palo Verde Peninsula. You go up basically the entire path of the Eastern Sierra. The foothills is in that area. And then you have places that are not entirely inside one of those areas, but they have neighborhoods that suck into these canyons and things like that that are built in there. So it's a problem that spans the entire state.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, in terms of trying to change policy related to, or at least inform the conversation on changing policy related to the risk that we all face, what's been the reaction that has most validated all of the time and effort that your reporting team has spent on the story?
We always, as a news organization, look at readership, and it's easier to look at readership now than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. It's immediate. We have live screens that display how many people are reading a story at a particular time. This is all, of course, online, digital only. How long they're staying with the story, where they might be. Are they in Los Angeles or San Francisco or Sacramento or San Jose? We were very encouraged when we hit publish that we saw strong readership and that we saw good engage time. So folks stayed with the stories, the reporting that we did. However, the collaborative nature of the project also meant that there are others who are engaging with the work, or we hoped that there would be. And the Associated Press distributed the stories and photos for us on the AP Wire. And they reported very strong download rates, so we were excited about that. And they heard from member organizations in other states who wanted to begin to think about how they might collaborate on projects in their home states. So we thought, okay, well, maybe we did something right here. We'll continue to do collaborative work on this project. We have a couple of stories to come about evacuation routes and whether we are accurately, effectively prepared to evacuate from some of the local communities, which, as we know, is a problem in Paradise. And so I would say the early signs are encouraging. Certainly we heard Newsom weigh in. Is there a piece of legislation that has been introduced as a result? No. Is the window open for introduction of legislation at this point in time? No.
But there is a bill pending that would make low interest loans available for or no interest loans, I believe, available for this sort of home hardening. And what I thought was cool on a personal level was when we were doing our interviews, hearing scientists, fire scientists, take a look at our data and say, this is impressive. We can use this data to actually, the maps and what you guys have made, we could use this as a way to say, this is how we prioritize where that money should go. Mm-hmm. And when you have people who do this for a living, scientists, saying that, I thought that was really cool. On a personal level, that's always neat to see that we're doing important work.
What are the implications if we as a state don't address these issues, from everything from no interest loans to how it is that we build homes?
Well, I mean, I think that it might become too expensive to live in these places, or you can't get insurance for them. That's one of the things we're hearing through the reporting process, is that insurance companies are starting to jack up rates for homeowners living in these hard to defend communities.
As a matter of fact, recently we had a gentleman, he was a teacher, who lost his home in the campfire. And his insurance company actually went insolvent because of the fact that they were a smaller company and they did not have the ability to pay the claims because of the magnitude of the fire.
Well, and you've also got to figure that across the state, we've had a number of incidents where the big power companies have been found to be either responsible or they're suspected to be responsible for fires. At some point, that's going to tip over to higher rates. I mean, I think that's fair to say, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Yeah. And so it's going to come down to this sort of statewide, what is the tipping point between where it gets too expensive to insure your house or that your power rates go up, that instead people kind of, I think, are going to have to choose, what do we want to do? Do we invest this money that we're spending on the back end, on front end fire prevention efforts, thinning the forests around communities?
Thinning the forest. Now, you had written a little bit on that about showing pictures about the difference between a forest that, you know, 100 years ago or so mm-hmm. looked one way, and today it's much more overgrown and overbuilt. What's the story behind that?
Well, fire has always been a part of the landscape, and we, for the last 100 years, have been putting out every fire that popped up. And as a consequence of that, our forests have grown unnaturally dense in a lot of places. I mean, it's not, forests are these, you know, mosaic ecosystems of different things. But Native Americans were on the continent for 10,000 years actively setting fires to manage through these ecosystem-wide management. And we haven't, other than managing for timber stocks, we haven't really been doing forest management for the last 100 years. And as a result, we're seeing, you know, where once were stands of woods that look like kind of like parkland savanna. I mean, if you look at some of the historical photos versus what they look like now across the West, you've just got stacks of little tiny trees. And that's big fire risk.
We haven't been able to put this together yet to the extent that we would like, but we've had some conversations about how there are fewer places to put those materials if we do thin, right? There are fewer paper mills in this country.
Really?
And so while, yes, we could thin, and yes, it's certainly a cost-burdened solution, we need to find some place to take those material mm-hmm. I mean, after.
One of the challenges with, like, I mean, having a commercial logging component to these things helps offset the cost, right? But if you look at kind of what burned in the car fire that in the part, it started in Whiskeytown National Recreation Area and burned into Redding, there's really no commercial timber stocks in that area that burned through there. It's all chaparral and a bunch of trees that the mills don't want. So if you are going to do these aggressive fire management things, you have to figure out where to take this biomass. Do you take it to biomass power plants? There's not enough of those. Do you chip it? And so there's these huge logistical issues with this stuff. And
would those same logistical issues present themselves with people that are really living in isolated circumstances off in the woods with regards to either retrofitting their homes or in some way reducing their own fire risk?
Yeah, I mean, it's expensive. I mean, if you're going to trim a couple acres of land, you're looking at a couple $1,000s. You got to have tree service crews come in. If you're going to do it, then you want to make sure that you're not just hiring some guy, right? You want to have somebody that if they fall a tree on your house, right? So it's an expensive deal. And I think that's part of the challenge with all this stuff is to try to figure out a way, how do we do the front end stuff? Because the back end stuff is getting increasingly expensive.
I was just going to add, some of the reporting that Ryan and Dale Kassler did was with some residents in the communities in Chico and Paradise that were unable to clear themselves, even to do really, you know, just the basic, not let's take down a tree, right, but let's make sure that our property is responsibly, you know, clear. And physically, they were not able to do that work, right? And so we think we can go out and, you know, get that done in a morning. Well, you know, if you've got, someone who's less able to get out and do that, again, that presents a challenge. And so how do we as a community work together to support that neighbor.
And it's also, I mean, one of the things like we talked about, that the community of Arnold, which is the gateway to Calaveras, the Big Tree State Park, right? The challenge with their timber management issues was trees are a big deal there. Mm-hmm. And so how do you convince a community that loves its trees that you maybe need to take some down? And what ended up convincing them to do that was the big fire that burned through there.
And we're going to leave it there. Thank you both, and congratulations on the series.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. I'm Scott Syfax. See you next time right here on KVIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KVIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
At Five Star Bank, we create thoughtful solutions to help the Capital Region thrive, from economic development and education to public health and safety, issues that are vitally important to Sacramento's prosperity. We're proud to be part of the conversation and hope you'll join in.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.